Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. Chaos Radio 92.7, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. And I'd like to welcome today's guest to the show, back to the show, I should say. It's the great Glenn Greenwald from Salon.com. Welcome to the show, Glenn.
Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's good to talk to you again. For those who don't know, Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional litigator. He used to litigate constitutional law in the courts. Now he writes the blog at Salon.com explaining that Constitution's relevance, or should I say lack of it, when it comes to the policies and prerogatives of the current Bush-Cheney regime. Glad to talk to you again, and the subject today is the Protect America Act and the immunity for the telecom companies who have broken the law and so forth. I guess if I could just start, Glenn, by asking you, what is the Protect America Act, and what changes did it make in American law?
The Protect America Act was a bill that was passed by both houses of Congress back in August that amended the FISA law that has been in place since 1978, and it amended it in essence by significantly increasing the power of the federal government to eavesdrop on the conversations of Americans without warrants. It in essence provided that the president has the right to eavesdrop on virtually all international calls that Americans make or receive without receiving or obtaining warrants of any kind.
So the bill was
passed under great pressure by the Bush administration, essentially claiming that the Congress needed to pass a law quickly before it went away for its recess because they had indications that a big bad terrorist attack was about to happen on the Capitol, and unless they got these new powers, they'd be unable to stop it. And so Congress passed that law back in August, Orwellian name as always, the Protect America Act. The one good thing that they did was they put in a provision that said that the bill will sunset in 6 months, will lapse in 6 months, so that they could come back from their recess in September and consider it in a more deliberative way, and that's what they're doing, at least theoretically now.
Okay, now help clear some things up for me. My understanding is that under the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, that the FBI or the National Security Agency or whoever can actually go ahead and tap any phone they want for 72 hours, and then they can go to the FISA court and say, by the way, Judge, we've been tapping this phone. Please sign off on this warrant for us. Is that right?
Yeah, there's emergency provisions within the original FISA bill provides exactly as you described, that if there's an emergency need to begin wiretapping immediately, reasonable grounds to believe that it would meet the test for a warrant, once the court has the chance to look at it, then all the attorney general or his designee has to do is certify that that's the case when they can begin eavesdropping without a warrant and can do so for 72 hours.
So the changes in this law are for what? Just to tap everybody all the time just for fishing expeditions then? As opposed to an emergency, we got to tap this phone right now?
What happened was that there is one technological change that has taken place now that was not true back in 1978 when FISA was enacted, which is the original FISA never required a warrant to eavesdrop on foreign-to-foreign calls. That is, if someone in Iraq calls somebody in Afghanistan, the U.S. government is free to eavesdrop on those calls, foreign to foreign calls, outside of the borders of the United States, without having to get a warrant. And
sure,
that was always the intent of the original FISA bill, and that was always the case, that foreign to foreign calls didn't require warrants.
Right.
Now, because of the technological happenstance of fiber optics, certain foreign to foreign calls are routed through the United States, because that's where the fiber optic networks are. And earlier this year, a FISA judge ruled that under the language of the statute, foreign-to-foreign calls that are routed to the United States actually do require a warrant in order for the Bush administration to eavesdrop on them. And everybody agreed, even the most stringent civil libertarians in the Congress, like Russ Feingold and members of the House who are ardent libertarians or civil libertarians, agreed that that classification of calls should not require warrants. And so everybody was willing to amend FISA just strictly to say that foreign-to-foreign calls do not require warrants, even if they get routed through the United States. And once they indicated their willingness to make that one change to FISA that everybody, including me, agreed was necessary, or at least justifiable, that was when the Bush administration started saying, no, we need much more than that. And if you don't give us this bill that Mike McConnell says we need, you're going to leave us vulnerable to a terrorist attack. And when there's an attack, the blood will be on your hands. And the Democrats capitulating to that pressure, as they always do, and passed the bill that the administration wanted, granting whole sweeping new warrantless eavesdropping powers to the president.
Jeez, you know, I don't understand. Don't the Democrats read antiwar.com? Don't they know that every single time since September 11th that this government has threatened us with some sort of impending terrorist attack, they were lying? Every single time what the Democrats thought this was an exception, there was about to be an attack, and they would have to take the blame for it? I mean, come on.
Yeah, you know, I think if you're the Democrats, you know, you see the way they probably think about it is as follows. You know, they don't really care much about things like checks and balances and judicial oversight and warrants and the Fourth Amendment, obviously. And, you know, there's always a theoretical risk that there will be a terrorist attack. I mean, nobody says that it's impossible or inconceivable that there will be another one. And I think their idea is, look, we're sitting pretty now. Every poll shows that, you know, we're in the lead in terms of party identification and generic congressional ballots and presidential races. And so we don't want to do anything to rock the boat. And if, you know, just in the rare chance that there is a terrorist attack in this interim, we don't want to give the president a political weapon. So we're just going to continue to give him what he wants. And, you know, hopefully in 2008, we expect that we'll have a Democrat in the White House who will get to use all these great new powers that were created.
Okay. Now, Glenn, you're a former constitutional litigator, and forgive me because I'm just going from memory here, but the law of the land does, in fact, say that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the places to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Is that not the case?
That is true. That's what the Fourth Amendment says.
And so, basically, the 1978 FISA Act was already unconstitutional before they even started tinkering with it. They were already violating our Fourth Amendment.
Well, it's interesting. There was a Supreme Court case in 1972 where the Nixon administration had, there was a whole variety of domestic terrorist groups that were opposed to the Vietnam War and other aspects of the Nixon administration's domestic policy. And they were going around blowing things up here and there. And the Nixon administration and the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover were conducting terrorism investigations into these domestic terrorist groups. And one of the things they did was they began eavesdropping on telephone calls without warrants, without search warrants, as the Fourth Amendment requires. And the case made its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Nixon administration said, under the Constitution, the president has the duty, a constitutional duty, to protect the American people from these attacks, and therefore he's entitled to eavesdrop without warrants because the Constitution grants him this power. And by an 8-0 decision written by a Nixon appointee, Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court said, no, the Fourth Amendment, for purposes of investigating domestic terrorism cases, prohibits any eavesdropping without warrants. That the search warrant, the probable cause requirement of the Fourth Amendment, requires you to get a warrant if you want to eavesdrop. They said, you know, we're only dealing with the question of domestic terrorism cases and not international terrorism cases and in international terrorist groups, which might create different questions because then involves war and peace and matters of the military. But the analysis of that decision was exactly the same as it would be for any context, which is that the language of the Fourth Amendment is clear that the whole purpose of what the founders created was that the executive on its own can never both investigate and make decisions about who shall be investigated. They investigate, they go to a court, they convince a court that there's probable cause to believe that you've committed a crime, and only then can they search your home or intrude into your conversations. And whether it's domestic terrorism or international terrorism, the law, the constitutional law, is crystal clear.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't have anything to hide, so I don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why the Democrats capitulate is because, and I've talked to a lot of them, both in the past month and in the past couple of years, and especially in the past month, about this pending FISA bill, to people in Congress, to senior aides, to senators, and other people like that, about what can be, if anything, to making this FISA bill permanent. And what they all think, what they all believe, and what they will all tell you is that it's a losing issue for them because, just as you suggested, Americans don't really care about these liberties, that they don't really think that if you have anything to hide, if you have nothing to hide, there's any reason to worry. They think the government's not interested in what they're talking about. And polls actually show that that's not quite true, that, you know, it's not as though there's some, you know, raving crying political movement in this country demanding warrantless surveillance or amnesty for telecoms, people realize that there are things that make our country different, things in the Constitution that restrain what our government does. We're taught that from the time we're children. The problem is there are no political leaders making those arguments, making appeals grounded in that. And so it's just not prominent in our political discourse. And if people in the country see both Republicans and Democrats basically agreeing that there's nothing wrong with violating the Constitution, there's nothing wrong with giving the president powers that the founders didn't want him to have, of course they're going to conclude, well, there must not be anything particularly wrong with it. I rely on the two-party system, and if there's something really wrong that one side wants to do, I expect the other one to be stomping their feet and yelling and screaming. When they see that that doesn't happen, they assume that there must not be anything particularly alarming about it.
Mm-hmm. You put that so well. That's exactly the way it is. Same thing with the accusations against Iran, for example. Well, the Democrats all voted for the bill that made all the accusations, so it's true now. If it wasn't true, the Democrats wouldn't have all voted for it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it was a 75-25 vote, and I think you're exactly right. The American people who, you know, you and I, as part of what we do, you know, either as a vocation or our living or whatever, are very unusual in the amount of attention that we're able to pay to the political process. Most Americans rely upon, you know, either political pundits in the establishment press and more importantly, their representatives, the politicians that they have asked and sent to Washington. You know, they assume that given how poorly the Iraq war has turned out, that they assume that, you know, the Congress is not going to empower this president to start another war against another country based on the same exact accusations about nuclear programs and all of that, unless there's good reason. And I think you're right. When they see, you know, Hillary Clinton, the leading Democratic candidate, and most of the Senate Democrats voting to declare, you know, part of Iran's military a terrorist organization and essentially use the language of war against Iran as this resolution, they assume that this threat must be real that time. I mean, there's nobody really making the case in a way that is really resonating with them. People who don't, you know, troll the internet looking for counter opinions, who rely on, you know, the mainstream discourse, they're not exposed to the arguments that demonstrate why this is all the same kind of hysteria and deceit that led us into Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm sure you saw that Bill Moyers special about the media a few months back.
I did.
There's one scene in there, I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was somebody from ABC News, maybe. And he said they had this thing that they would do to Ronald Reagan called truth squatting, where they would ask him a question and he would give an answer that had no truth to it. And then they would have another reporter on the other side of the room follow up, and they would keep after him until he had to admit that he was wrong or, you know, whatever it was. And they got so much pressure from that, for being such Reagan haters, that a new policy was invoked from on high. And the new policy was, you may not contradict the president unless someone from the other party does. Then you can cover that. But unless someone from the other party contradicts him, then you are not to. And that's basically where we're at right now. If Hillary Clinton said that Dick Cheney was a liar, then we could discuss it. But since she is a liar and goes along with every one of his lies, then there's nothing to dispute.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on the really important point. And actually, I focused on that point for the first time when I watched that Bill Moyers special as well, because actually, and it might be the same thing we were talking about, but it might be different. But Tim Russert was interviewed as part of that by Bill Moyers about why the press did such an unbelievably poor job in investigating and subjecting to scrutiny claims by the Bush administration prior to the Iraq war. And what he said, in essence, was what you just described, which was the duty to dispute what the government is saying is the duty of the opposition party. And if the opposition party doesn't do that, then the fault lies with them, not with us. And,
right.
And the premise of that is that our duty as journalists confined to calling up the government and writing down what they say, and then calling up the other side, the Democrats, and writing down what they say. And if among what they say is not the truth, then we won't report the truth, and it isn't our fault. Our only duty is to be equal stenographers, to write down what both sides say and go home at night and get a good night's sleep. And, you know, that clearly is what the role of the establishment press is. And it, more than anything else, that's what's killing our political culture.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know if you're a Simpsons fan, Glenn, but are you familiar with the character on The Simpsons, Rich Texan?
Not really.
Oh, well, there's a
character. Lightly.
There's a character on The Simpsons named Rich Texan, and he always yells, "Yeehaw!" and carries pistols everywhere he goes and has a bunch of oil money, apparently, et cetera, like that. Well, I bring that up because I met a guy exactly like Rich Texan from The Simpsons about, I think this was before September 11th, actually. And he was smoking a big cigar and had been drinking whiskey all night and had very loose lips, and started telling me the story of how he and his brother had created some telecom in Houston that was apparently some big deal during the dot-com boom or what have you, and how the National Security Agency came to him and his brother and said, listen, you're going to build your company from the ground up with us, and if you don't, then you are doomed. We're going to regulate you right out of business. You're going to do everything we say. And this guy, Rich Texan, was scared to death. The way he was talking to me, and he was kind of drunk, the way he was talking to me was, I'm frightened. I left the business to my brother and quit. And, you know, I don't go near windows now. I'm scared of these guys. And this was something from long before September 11th. The National Security Agency, assuming we can take this guy's word for it, came to him and said, oh, so you're going to build the telecom, huh? Well, this is Mr. Jenkins from the National Security Agency, and he'll be building your network with you from the ground up, and you have no choice.
I mean, I believe that, and I'll tell you why. I actually wrote about this today. And you know, there's a lot of documents coming out, finally, about some of these issues as a result of the criminal prosecution of Joseph Mascio, who was the CEO of Qwest Communications. And Qwest was one of the companies that was approached by the Bush administration prior to September 11th and as well as after September 11th, demanding that it cooperate fully in turning over its customer databases and providing unfettered access to the calls of its customers to the National Security Agency. And while AT&T and Verizon and most of the telecom industry agreed to do so, Qwest refused because they believed that what they were being asked to do was illegal, which it was, and they were concerned about legal liability. And as a result, the Bush administration ended up criminally prosecuting the CEO for insider trading. And in any event, as part of his criminal case, a lot of documents have been disclosed slowly and in partial form, heavily redacted. But still, what they demonstrate is really rather something extraordinary, which is the extent to which the national security officials of our government in the National Security Agency and in the Pentagon, and not just in the Bush administration, in the Clinton administration too, but certainly escalated significantly before 9/11 with the Bush administration, work so cooperatively with the telecom executives of our country, almost hand in hand. They're essentially a consortium working together, building networks, ensuring access. And billions of dollars of taxpayer money are being transferred to these telecoms in order to ensure government access to these vast telecommunications networks and the maintenance of databases, vast databases about who we call and who calls us, and unfettered access literally tapping right into the telecommunications systems and telecommunications companies that refuse don't get the regulatory favors that they need in order to prosper. They get intimidated and threatened. And in the case of the Qwest CEO, they get prosecuted. And what's so interesting about it is, you know, Mike McConnell, before he became the Director of National Intelligence, he was essentially the point man for the telecom industry, coordinating these efforts to vastly increase the cooperation between the federal government and the telecom industry in terms of outsourcing and privatizing everything the government wanted to do to the telecom so that the government has unfettered access to this telecommunication infrastructure. It's incredibly alarming. And beyond alarming, it's also something that's happening in almost virtual secrecy. I mean, there's no congressional investigation into it. The only chance we really have to learn about any of this are these lawsuits that are pending against the telecoms, which is why the Bush White House and the telecom industry and the Congress are so eager to grant amnesty to these telecoms, because doing that will put an end to these lawsuits and an end to our only chance to really learn about what's going on.
Wow, yeah, that's really groundbreaking stuff. And that's, by the way, if you go to Glenn Greenwald's blog at Salon.com, that is the top entry today, I believe, right?
Right, I did write about that today. Yeah. I spent the week of reading those Mascio documents and was really impressed by, you know, Condoleezza Rice and General Hayden and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Clark, all before September 11th, in one meeting after the next with telecom officials working on these joint government telecom projects.
Mm-hmm. I really like the way you put that, and I think that that's the closest to the truth that you can get, is that really there is no distinction. The telecom industry of this country is basically part of the national government. Or, you know,
right.
Vice versa,
and
I guess.
Well, it is. And you know, what's so amazing about it is, I mean, you know, it's been recognized for a long, long time. I mean, the Communications Act it was passed in 1934, and there were provisions in that bill all the way back in 1934 that prohibited telecoms from disclosing information about their customers without a court order, precisely because they knew how sensitive the information was that was being invested in these private companies. And to now have that wall completely eroded, where there is no distinction really between, it's pure corporatism. It's really a merging of the public and private, public and private sectors. So that all that data, all of that information, all of that access to our calls is now vested in the federal government with no oversight, no court warrants, nothing, is dangerous beyond what can really be described.
Well,
and illegal, not to mention.
And now tell me more about Mike McConnell. He's now the National Intelligence Director, which is basically the new DCI, right? What exactly was his role in this before?
Well, Mike McConnell was at various telecommunications companies. There's actually a great article in Salon that was written during the time that the Senate was considering whether to confirm him, which essentially made the argument that, you know, one of the real concerns about putting him in this position was that he was the principal liaison between the telecommunications companies and the Bush administration when it came to trying to expand the amount of cooperation between those two efforts. I forget where he worked, but after he was an admiral, he left and joined the private sector. And actually, I can tell you, oh, he was with Booz Allen. That's right. He was an executive with Booz Allen, actually the director of defense programs at Booz Allen Hamilton, which is the nation's biggest defense and intelligence contractor. And he created an association between all the defense and telecom agencies designed to vastly expand the amount of privatization that the federal government did in terms of outsourcing its government defense and intelligence functions to the private sector, to basically make the telecom industry a division of the federal government. And what Mike McConnell did, he was a key figure in the private sector telecom companies, and that's why it's such an unbelievable conflict of interest for him now as Director of National Intelligence to argue that the same companies that just a couple of years ago he was working for and had vested interest in must have amnesty from these lawsuits because national security requires that they have it. It's a complete obvious conflict of interest. And he was placed in that position because the telecoms are such a vital part of what our federal government does in the intelligence and defense realm.
Wow. And if possible, I'd like to go back to this, the story of Joseph Nasio, is that right, at Quest?
Mm-hmm.
He was prosecuted for insider trading. Now, what does that say about the rule of law? Was there any actual insider trading, or they were persecuting him basically because he wouldn't go along? That's what it sounds like.
Well, you know, the problem is that, you know, it's a bit like tax evasion. You know, the government could probably, if it wanted to, build certainly an indictable case against virtually anybody who files taxes and does anything more than the most simplistic deductions and claim that, you know, expense deductions that someone took or income that they classified a certain way was fraudulent. And that's why, you know, so many people are at the government's mercy when it comes to tax evasion convictions. The same is true for insider trading. When an executive of a company sells his stock shortly before the fortunes of that company decline precipitously, there's always the suspicion raised that the stock was sold because the executive had insider knowledge that the public didn't have, that the company was about to tank and the stock price was going to go down, and that's why he sold it. So, you know, whether this was a valid case of insider trading or not, I don't know. What I do know is that the Department of Justice and the Bush administration has pursued very few cases against business executives, certainly in the telecommunications area, for transactions of this type, and yet they pursued it very vigorously against the CEO of one of the few telecoms that resisted the National Security Agency's demands to allow access to their customers' database.
Yeah, no secret what's going on there. And you're right, they can charge anybody with basically anything, right? Mail fraud, if nothing else, they'll get you. If you ever accepted anything in your mailbox, you're guilty of something.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about that prosecution, though, is that one of the things that he's trying to show is he's trying to say, at the time I sold my stock, I actually had the opposite expectation. I didn't think my company was going to tank. I thought we were going to make huge amounts of money because look at all these government contracts, these lucrative government contracts that I was meeting with the Bush administration over and that I was being promised the Bush administration was involved in this project and this project and this project and this project with the telecommunication industry, and they were trying to get us on board in order to cooperate with all of them. And that's why these documents have become so interesting, because in trying to prove that defense, he has disclosed all sorts of facts that reveal the extent to which the government and the telecommunications companies are working hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big points there, and you mentioned this, is the secrecy. This is the kind of thing that judges are, you know, quote-unquote, admitting that they don't have the authority to rule over because it's a state secret. It's the kind of thing that Congress doesn't want to do anything about except aid and abet. And, you know, where do we go to learn about this stuff other than, you know, Glenn Greenwald's blog at Salon.com?
Yeah, or anti-war. You know, that's really one of the most interesting things. And I went around today just kind of casually, and I looked at, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and some of the political sites that, you know, just engage in endless trashy gossip over, you know, the day-to-day campaigns of the various individuals running for president. And you look at what our political press is talking about, and then you contrast it to the most high impact and the most significant things that are going on. And the things that actually matter, the things that actually involve billions and billions of dollars of our national treasure, that involve our core constitutional liberties, they're not only being ignored by the media, but they're basically operating and occurring almost completely in the dark. I mean, the idea of any open government is almost just a complete fiction at this point. The most significant things occur almost all completely in secrecy, and things are routinely classified as secret without any real reason. And so you're absolutely right. I mean, these things that are going on are things we learn about in drips and drabs almost accidentally through inadvertent or incorrect disclosures and piecing things together. And whether we want our government engaging in this massive databases of recording everything we do is something that, you know, we ought to debate, but we can't debate it because they're already doing it. They're doing it without our knowledge.
Now, when I think it was Garrett Garrett's book, The People's Pottage, that he wrote back in the early 1940s, and the first section is called The Revolution Was. And he talks about how don't look for the revolution coming. It already came in the night of the Great Depression, singing songs of freedom and so forth. And I wonder whether the experience of the last 6.5 or so years living under Bush Cheney in the United States, do you see this as truly a further revolution within the form of American government? It does seem at this point that they have so much power and so much disregard for what the letter of the law says that really this is ex-America.
Whether what's going on now is fundamentally different than what's gone on since, you know, say, the New Deal or the end of World War II and the creation of the national security state, or whether it's really just an extension or continuation of it, is almost semantic. You know, I was having a discussion a couple of days ago with a reader of my blog who was very enthusiastic about a book she had just read called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, which sort of detailed how Harry Truman, when he created the CIA, invested it with all sorts of power to do all kinds of things, from overthrowing other governments to basically acting as a worldwide police force. You know, really there was no legitimate constitutional or legal basis at the time for that kind of wild, unchecked, new, you know, executive force that was going to operate in the world. And yet once that was created and unleashed, and of course Dwight Eisenhower warned about it in his farewell address, it kind of set us on this course of this vast, unchecked national security apparatus that operates in the dark. I think there's a difference, though, in that, you know, even in the 1970s, when we started investigating that in the wake of the Nixon abuses and realized the extent to which it had gone really out of control and run rampant, we did put Congress regulatory schemes and laws into place that at least required oversight and provided some regulation for that, so that the extent to which it could operate secretly was severely diminished. And I think that's really been the departure since 9/11, is the complete abolition of that entire oversight and regulatory scheme, returning to the period where, you know, when it was first created and when the abuses were at their greatest, when all of this operated completely in the dark at the behest of an unchecked executive. And that, I do think, is new. And you know, it's unprecedented because that apparatus is so extraordinarily powerful now. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a military that spends, you know, more than every other country combined, all all of that placed under, and a $40 billion intelligence agency, all placed under the unchecked power and command of essentially one man in the president with no oversight and no checks, it's obviously an invitation for extraordinary abuse.
And now part of that is that the intelligence agencies are supposed to report to the House and Senate intelligence committees, but the more that they outsource covert activity types operations, and I guess including spying, to the military, then they don't have to talk to the Senate intelligence committees. They don't have to reveal anything. It's got that whole other layer of secrecy over it. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And beyond that, though, I mean, you know, there's so many layers of it that prevent any oversight. I mean, even when it was, even things that were within the CIA, I mean, you talk about the rendition and the interrogation programs, or even the National Security Agency's multiple surveillance programs, data mining and databases and warrantless surveillance. The Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee were kept almost completely in the dark and didn't mind that. I mean, they voted several times not to investigate various programs. And so even when it was in the Intelligence Committee and you theoretically had oversight, those oversight functions failed. The press is supposed to provide yet another mechanism, of course, for investigating and checking. And while there have been some instances where that's occurred, I mean, the Washington Post uncovered the black sites and the New York Times uncovered the warrantless surveillance program, by and large, the press has ignored virtually all of this and then taking it in, and that was Rumsfeld and Cheney's great innovation, so many of the most controversial programs and putting them in the Pentagon, as you say, really put it beyond the reach, even theoretically, of any oversight. And that's why I say most of what is most important that our government has done has occurred largely in the dark.
And this is the kind of thing that just, it's a little thing, I guess, but it's so obnoxious to me. You know, the White House for a time there tried to rename suicide bombing homicide bombing. And I guess they all picked up on it for about a week or so. And then Fox News are the only ones who kept it up. Everybody else went back to calling it suicide bombing and so forth. But that's what happened with this warrantless wiretapping, which on its face by its name is clearly illegal. They renamed it the Terrorist Surveillance Program. And it's not just Fox News. It's the Post and the Times and the L.A. Times and the Miami Herald and the Chicago Tribune and the Dallas Morning News and the Associated Press, and everybody in this whole country refers to this warrantless wiretapping as a terrorist surveillance program. Who could possibly be opposed to that?
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, one of the things that I did is in writing my last book was I spent a long time reading news accounts from 2002 and 2003 in terms of how they were reporting on the so-called debate that we have had over the war in Iraq. And one of the things I'd forgotten about, I think I blocked it out just because it's too grotesque of a memory to maintain, was that the Pentagon had created those playing cards with the pictures of all the bad guys. And
oh,
everyone
right.
had a, you know, five of clubs and nine of diamonds, and of course Saddam was the ace of spades and his sons were the ace of hearts and ace of clubs. And in reporting on the war, virtually every media outlet used those playing cards to refer to the various villains. And, you know, they all had Lex Luthor-like names like Dr. Germ and Mrs. Anthrax, Chemical
right.
Ali, and you know, you could go to their websites even now, and there's like the New York Times and CNN, all of them, they have interactive playing decks where you can click on the various numbers and suits, and up pops the bad person with their cartoon name underneath and an X over their face when they've been apprehended or killed. This is the sort of thing, I mean, that the media does in much the same way that the telecom industry plays the role of a division of the Intelligence and Defense Department of the federal government. The media really does play a propagandistic role for the government because they go to the government almost exclusively, certainly primarily, to get their information. And the information that they get, they end up reciting and repeating in the form that they're given it with virtually no investigation, no skepticism, and no critical thought. And all the real role that they play is simply to amplify government claims and to give them credibility. And whether it's, you know, domestic surveillance or the torture program, which is now coerced interrogation or enhanced interrogation techniques, or, you know, as we've just been discussing, the new Hitlers in Iran or the old Hitlers in Iraq, you will find in virtually every case the media reciting the narrative of the government.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, too. I guess if we went back through that deck of cards, through some of the ones that they didn't catch, I wonder how many of those guys now are our new allies in Petraeus's redirection and Sunni awakening and the new alliance with the Sunni insurgency. How many of those guys are good guys now from that same deck?
Right, the ones we're probably giving lots and lots of arms and cash to in order to convince them not to kill us for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all our good friends now. And, in fact, I read something. I wish I remember the guy's name. I read something not long ago about one of these former Baathist leaders who you could give this guy one of those cartoon nicknames. You know, this guy's one of Saddam Hussein's most horrible henchmen, is now an ally of the United States there. Sorry, I wish I could remember the guy's name off the top of my head.
Right. It all switches. You know, and of course, a principal Orwellian theme was that, you know, the only thing that governments really care about is making sure that we're always at war. Who the enemy is switches from moment to moment, and our enemy of today is our friend of yesterday, and vice versa. And you see that as clearly as, you know, it could possibly be seen. I mean, look, you know, we were attacked September 11th by a Sunni extremist, and a couple of years later, we're working now with the Sunnis because suddenly the Shiites in the Middle East are our great enemies, the Shiites in Iran. And so, I mean, it just shifts constantly, because the theme of enemy is but the pretext to justify the endless war, and that's when you get that incoherence.
Mm-hmm. And the media goes along, this goes back to that Bill Moyers special about the media again, a wonderful quote of Dan Rather, I'm paraphrasing here. He said, nobody has to send you a memo that reminds you that the company you work for is regulated by the national government from top to bottom, and that if you cross them, that you're putting your corporation in serious danger. Nobody has to remind you. Really, it's the same thing with the telecoms as it is with the TV and the radio, right? Is they can't cross the national government because the national government owns the airwaves, owns their license, and can regulate them right out of business.
Yeah, you know, I think that's entirely right. You know, there was a recent book that was written by the media critic of CNN and the Washington Post, Howard Kurtz, and he recounts a story that was told by Katie Couric when she was at NBC, and she had conducted an interview with Condoleezza Rice in 2004, where, at least for Katie Couric, it was somewhat of an acrimonious interview. And she asked the same question three or four times that Rice had patently refused to answer, and after the interview, she received an email that was sent to her by her boss at NBC News, which was in the form of a viewer complaint, complaining that Couric was too aggressive and too impolite with Condoleezza Rice, and her boss forwarded that to her, and she said it was a clear signal to her that they did not want her being that aggressive with Bush administration officials. And of course, the CEO at the time of General Electric, which owned NBC, was Jack Welch, whose company relied on all sorts of contacts with the Bush administration, and who himself was a great war supporter and supporter of the Bush administration. And there's all sorts of overlapping ties between the corporations that own the media and the media itself. So when that happens, as you say, there's no need for centralized directives to reporters about what to say and what not to say. They know the culture in which they work. They know the aims of those corporate executives, and they know that if they want to advance their careers, they need to promote those aims and not undermine them.
Oh, man, Glenn Greenwald, I feel like you just punched me in the head and just sent me hurtling into perception of reality. The United States Today, Katie Couric, rogue reporter, must be made to back off.
Scary that she's an example of an aggressive and adversarial reporter. It's really an indication of the state of things. But, you know, the one thing I want to say is, you know, a lot of times when I write about these issues anyway, readers on my blog and elsewhere, I mean, the reaction I get is, oh, this is also depressing and it seems so grim and what has happened to our country. And yet, you know, I think that there is lots of cause for believing that things can change and are changing. And obviously there is intense dissatisfaction among the American citizenry with what's happening in Washington and with the government, and technology allows all sorts of alternative means for redressing these grievances and for communicating the truth and for investigating and disclosing information. And that's what blogs are and alternative sites like yours are for, and I think that those are growing in power. And I think the more dissatisfied the citizenry becomes, the more anger there is, the more that can be tapped into solutions. So it is depressing and it is infuriating, but I think there's plenty of grounds for believing that things can be done about it as well.
Well, I sure appreciate that sentiment. It's a nice little bit of optimism to end the interview on, and I think you're right. I think ultimately, you know, there's whatever certain percentage of the population of this country that doesn't care either way. But there's another percentage of us that do care, and more are getting our priorities straight and seeing what the real challenges are and what needs to be faced. And thanks to people like you, Glenn Greenwald, we have good information to go to. At least we can be informed when we get in our arguments with the war party, and we can win them.
So, yeah, I agree with that, that entirely, and I think, you know, information is power, and that's a cliche, but I think it's true as well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everybody, you heard it. It's Glenn Greenwald. He's from Salon.com, former constitutional law litigator. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for the great questions. Appreciate it. Bye.